Case number 19-5753, USA versus Jamar Garrison. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Ms. Rabin, you may proceed for the appellant.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Margaret Rabin. I represent the appellant Jamar Garrison in this direct appeal from his jury convictions. I raised five issues in my brief. I want to concentrate my argument on three of them. The issues relating to the discovery violations, the issues relating to the abuse of discretion in denying the defense the ability to cross-examine the government's star witness, and then the last issue I raised, which is I'll characterize as the rehafe argument. With regard to the discovery violations, the question that probably arises, why does this make any difference? And the reason it makes a difference is because the defense in this case was predicated. The defense was sloppy investigation, failure to test the evidence, hidden witnesses, staged photos of the evidence in place, questionable witnesses, all equal to beyond a reasonable doubt. And the primary piece of that was the failure to do any scientific testing. The pretrial order in this case required disclosure of test exams and results. It clearly covered this fingerprint evidence test. And the fact that it is a negative test doesn't make any difference for purposes of this argument, because the argument was that it allowed the defense to blunder into this argument that there had been no testing, when in fact there had been testing. The other part of the
Counselor, can you suggest with a little more specificity how you would have altered the defense?
What comes to mind is perhaps the case might not have even gone to trial. But for the government to not know.
I'm sorry, because Judge Strange's question is a good one. Don't you have to demonstrate how things would be different? In other words, how the delay resulted in prejudice that materialized, made something different in this case, an outcome different, or something of the sort?
Yes, I think I do. And I think the outcome is the defense opening statement, which states, there has been no scientific testing here to determine who actually had their fingers on the gun and the drugs that were hidden in the truck.
And I agree it's problematic that the government didn't turn that over sooner, but the ultimate burden remains on you at this point, right? To show that delay resulted in prejudice. And just saying it would have said one statement differently doesn't demonstrate prejudice.
Well, I think it does, Your Honor.
Okay, and explain why.
It cut out the defense. It simply eviscerated the part of the defense that was predicated on the failure to testing is part of the reason why you should have reasonable doubt.
But he, as you pointed out, that I'm sorry, was it a man or a woman that was the defense attorney below?
At trial, it was a man.
And he said, so staged photographs, hidden witnesses, lack of fingerprint evidence, and two likely suspects create reasonable doubt. So it's one in a series. It's not, you know, the primary focus of the defense, nor was it throughout the trial. It was just one in a series, as you said, of investigative blunders.
Well, I disagree with you, because the principal argument was going to be no scientific testing. Why didn't they test the drugs and the gun for fingerprints? That would have answered the question of who, at least, had their fingerprints on it when it was hidden in the truck. And I do not understand how the government gets to violate its discovery obligations, and there are no consequences. The only one who's
counsel, this is Judge Boggs, that you do have to show some prejudice, and when it came out that the fingerprint result was negative, that is, they couldn't determine it, doesn't that play into your defense that they even tried and they couldn't find anything on my client? It's a little bit different, but it sort of helps. And did you or your counsel below tell the jury that they just now let us know this? They had been hiding that all this time and just now let us know that they couldn't find any fingerprints.
You, Judge Boggs, I was not trial counsel. Right. Trial counsel did not do anything with the belated disclosure. I will say that. And perhaps he could have, but he did not. But what happens with that belated disclosure is, frankly, it makes the defense attorney look like an idiot, like a liar in his opening statement.
Does it, or does it make the government look like they're bungling this case? Because isn't the point that he could have and should have made, look, I've been demanding this all along, and now the government turns it over, and it doesn't have my guy's fingerprints on it. So surprise, surprise, they hid this from me, and it doesn't have my guy's fingerprints on it.
Your Honor, perhaps that is something that trial counsel should have done. He did not do it. I will agree with that. There was no argument or testimony in front of the jury, at least, about the circumstances of this failure to disclose. The second
Did it matter part, that he was then allowed to recall the witness? Is that sufficiently remedial or not?
Well,
that the court allowed him to recall the witness if he wanted and question him about the report.
Well, the witness was Louisville Police Detective Crawford, who yes, could have been recalled. I'm not sure that they had closed his testimony when the issue of actual disclosure of the report occurs, because the government takes the position at trial. Well, there is no report. Like what Crawford testifies to. And then ultimately it turns out, yes, indeed, there is a report. It's not been disclosed. If the government doesn't know about it, I'm sorry. Kyles versus Whitley says that doesn't make any difference. The government is required to look for it. And they took this case, the feds took this case over from the state. I don't have an explanation for why it wasn't disclosed.
Well, assuming that we all agree, or we will, let's just assume that we do agree that it's a Brady material, it was a violation of Rule 16 and the pretrial order, that still leads us back to the materiality question, doesn't it? What's your best argument for why the delayed disclosure satisfies that materiality requirement that makes that undermines confidence in the integrity of the conviction?
My best argument is it allowed the defense to posit a defense, to create a part of a defense here that in fact was based on untruth. There had been testing. It wasn't disclosed. It allowed the defense attorney to make an argument to the jury that he could not prove because of the government's failure to disclose this report, that they should have had it, they should have disclosed it. It's no big deal. It's a negative fingerprint report. Why, that's the best I can say on this. I would like to move on to the rehafe argument. I filed my pleading in this case for the Ward case, for Ray Moore, before this, there's been a string now of Sixth Circuit cases talking about rehafe in the context of a plain error argument where the trial occurred before rehafe. I understand that the governing case is U.S. v. Ward. The concern I have about the Ward case is it's being cited, and the government did cite it, for the principle that an old chief stipulation is enough to satisfy the third and fourth elements of the plain error review. I think that case law says that that is not completely correct, that the third element, which is the reasonable probability that but for the error, the outcome would have been different, allows the court to look at the trial evidence. What evidence was presented at trial? And in this case, there wasn't any other evidence that would allow the jury to make the factual finding that Garrison knew about the prior conviction, as opposed to, in fact, being convicted.
I don't understand. Under Old Chief, if the government is forced to stipulate, it's one of the rare occasions the government can be forced to stipulate, then if I was the trial judge and they tried to introduce evidence of the prior conviction, I would probably declare a mistrial. I mean, how can they do it once the stipulation is entered? And isn't it true this guy had 27 felonies after age 18?
Let me take it in parts, Judge Thapar. Okay. All right. The trial judge here certainly would not have been able to allow the government to introduce evidence on that issue. It's pre-rehafe. We all know that. Rehafe flipped the script.
But even post-rehafe, you couldn't introduce evidence if the defendant stipulated.
Well, I'm not so sure about that. Because the defendants,
you definitely don't want that to be the law. A lot of defense attorneys are going to want your throat.
Well, they do as a general matter anyway. But what I'm saying is that the old chief stipulations now are going to have different language in them. And I'm certainly seeing this already in the Eastern District of Michigan, is the old chief stipulation now includes the specific, I'll call it the rehafe language. In it. The question is, the government would not have been expected to do this. Could they have done it? Well, a prior conviction is usually admissible if you have the supporting documents for it. And my client does have prior felonies. But that argument, I think, goes to the fourth element, whether there is a substantial impact on the fairness, integrity, and reputation of judicial proceedings. And in this case, there is. My client is serving 15 years on the felon in possession conviction, count one, because—
How can it be unfair if he has 27 prior felonies in whatever it is, 12 years?
Because he has to be convicted of every element of the offense in order for it to be
evidence. If you look at Nader, even on a harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard, which is lower than plain error, if the evidence is overwhelming of the element that the element would be met, then we need not send it back to the jury.
That goes back to the issue of, does the fact of the conviction necessarily require that the defendant know of the know that he has a felony conviction? Though that's the distinction the cases are making. And when they're looking at the evidence at trial, they're looking for other evidence that the defendant knew it. And in some cases, it's pretty simple. They've got a recorded telephone call from the jail saying, I knew I shouldn't have the guns. Or they've got a conversation from a witness who says, well, he told me he knew he wasn't supposed to have any of this stuff. That's what's missing from this case. And if we're results oriented, maybe it doesn't make any difference. But the process and the procedure here, the fairness of Garrison's trial is, I think, compromised right out of the gate. From the defense opening statement, that trial was not fair in his conviction on the rehab argument. It's not fair. That's
Counselor, on rehab, help me understand what would you think that there it is appropriate to place into evidence a conviction for possession, a felon in possession? If one of those 27 he has already been convicted of being a felon illegally in possession of a firearm. Is that what you're getting to? That should be included in evidence? Or you think nothing other than the stipulation and then some current evidence that would show knowledge?
Are we talking pre-rehave or post-rehave?
But let's talk post. That's where we are.
Post-rehab, I'm sorry, my time is up. May I answer?
Please answer that.
Yes.
And summarize it.
Post-rehab, the government must prove defendant's knowledge of his prior conviction. I think they can do that any number of ways. And in fact, in every single post-rehab case that I've read, there has been something else in the trial that either in the trial or in the consideration of the substantial impact, the discretionary review part of plain error.
That's and your position is that there's nothing here.
My position is there is nothing in the trial record that would allow the court to say that that there is no reasonable probability that the result would have been different.
Are you saying that Old Chief is no longer good law, that the government doesn't have to accept the stipulation post-rehave?
No, I'm not saying that. But okay. I'm saying that what will happen is the Old Chief stipulation will be rewritten to include the rehave element, and the defendant just takes it or leaves it.
Thank you for your arguments. Did you reserve rebuttal time?
I did, yes, ma'am.
You will have that. Thank you. Mr. Cushing?
May it please the court, Terry Cushing for the United States. I want to go back to counsel's first argument on the discovery issue. One thing my colleague on the other side kind of leaves out is that Rule 16 requires a request for evidence. The pretrial order, the pretrial discovery order, also required a request for the evidence. The defendant never made a request for results of reports, tests, or any of that nature. Nothing in the line of Rule 16A1F. The motion that counsel made before trial spoke to physical evidence, did not speak to reports. The judge's order, when the judge entered the order granting the request for the Rule 16, the judge cited specifically Rule 16A1E. Not 16A1F, which would have covered this fingerprint report. So we don't have the request. We don't have an error here.
I'm struggling with that, counsel. I'm just struggling with the argument that there was not a request made. I thought by looking at the record that the request had been made both before trial and encapsulated in the court's order to you. The provision of scientific evidence or reports is just so common that I'm struggling with an argument that says you didn't ask exactly right, so we don't have to give it to you.
Well, I understand the concern there, Judge, but I invite you to read very closely the order, which is at Record 14, and it specifically does say that upon request,
The June 4th order says that the district court ordered the government, I'm quoting, to permit inspection and copying of or photographing of all subject to disclosure under Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 16. And I agree there has to be a request under the rule, but then Garrison made a request for exculpatory and impeaching information that included any and all physical evidence, as you point out, including but not limited to records and photos. Couldn't this be a record?
No, Judge, that's covered specifically in Rule 16A1E, not 16A1F.
16A1F. Are you saying that the government was aware of this report and didn't provide it because it wasn't requested, or are you saying that the government was unaware of the report?
No, Judge, the prosecution was unaware of the report. Now, we're still charged with knowing that it was there since it was in law enforcement. That was a mistake, but it was,
Can I just ask a process question? I'm kind of bewildered that a prosecutor would not ask the officers, did you fingerprint the evidence? That's like one of the number one checklist prosecutor questions you ask all officers.
It is, absolutely, Judge. And where the error occurred here, I'm not positive whether it was the prosecutor's error to make the request or if it was the detective's error missed this report. I don't know where the error occurred. There certainly was some error here. And our law certainly provides for and recognizes that there are, human error occurs. What we look at is what was the harm. So I'm going to go where the court did in its questioning and look at what the prejudice would be, even if this was a Rule 16 violation. There was no substantial prejudice here. For many of the reasons that the court discussed with my colleague on the other side, the fingerprint, the statement, the opening statement about the fingerprint evidence was a very small part of the opening. I feel like I'm repeating what has already been said, but it was also just a series of claims that the investigation was shoddy. The fact that we didn't realize that there was a report and turned it over during trial is a point, again, I feel like I'm repeating what's already been said, but a point that counsel could have made at the trial and used that within the same theme that he used in his opening statement. There simply was not a significant prejudice here to overturn this jury verdict. Also, we can look at the other evidence in this case. There was a substantial amount of evidence in this case. Garrison's pointing at Bullington and hitting on Bullington so hard kind of ignores Philip White. Philip White was the witness who testified that Garrison asked him to rent the truck for him first. And Philip White was the one who rented it for Garrison. And Garrison was driving it around and using it before Bullington ever even came into the picture. So that kind of undercuts his claim that Bullington was the one who put this evidence in the truck. And two, it's not very logical. Why would a drug dealer actually put evidence in a truck and have somebody else driving it around who doesn't know anything about it, isn't part of the business? So the evidence here is very strong, if not overwhelming. Garrison had the truck. He was in the truck. He was caught with the evidence, he was sweating in December, watching as the detectives found or officers found his drugs and his gun. He's the one with the substantial prior record I think it was 27 felony convictions. So the evidence here shows that this mistake was not something that altered the trial or made the trial an unfair one or would have had any effect on the verdict. We asked the court to affirm on that basis. If there's no more questions on that, just the only other thing we talked about this morning was Rehaif. And I'm sorry, if I was pronouncing Rehaif too until I went to a seminar and they were saying it's Rehaif, and I thought I might be offending somebody and mispronouncing their name. But on the Rehaif issue, if my opponent or my colleague on the other side doesn't like Ward, it really doesn't help her argument, because Ward is binding precedent in this circuit, and Ward makes sense. You have the stipulation.
Ward also say that although the stipulation of a prior felony does not automatically establish knowledge of felony status, it's strongly suggestive of it. It feels to me a little in this case that something else that we have noted in Raymore is that no other circuit to consider this question has used a stipulation like Garrison's as a thumb on the scale for finding that the error in the indictment did not affect the defendant's substantial rights. I'm wondering if we're moving away in argument from the concept that, yes, you stipulate it, but that's not the end of the game. In your analysis, it sounds like, well, you made the stipulation, we're done here. And I don't think that's what Ward says.
Well, no, it's not. And that wasn't our argument, with all due respect, Your Honor. Our argument was that the stipulation is evidence and that the court can consider, and it does weigh on the scale in favor of that there was harmless error here, or no plain error is where we are.
What else do you think is necessary?
Well, the whole record the court has at its disposal to look at to determine whether this was plain error or not. And here, Garrison had 27 felony convictions. He had four that qualified him as an armed career criminal. So these weren't just, oh, could that have been a misdemeanor or a felony? I'm not sure which one it was. These are serious crimes that resulted in a significantly enhanced sentence, and there are numerous ones. So it's the record here shows that that he knew he was a convicted felon, and the stipulation reflects that he wouldn't have wanted the jury to know the extent of his felony record.
Counsel, after Rehaif, your adversary talked about the practice in Michigan. Is anything changed in Kentucky in terms of when you get an old chief stipulation, do you have it say he was a felon and he knew it? How is that coming out nowadays?
Judge, I'm sorry, I don't know positively the answer to that question. I didn't think to discuss that with our criminal folks. I believe that's probably what we're doing. My guess is that it's probably pretty much across the board that most or all districts are including that language in the stipulation. And the stipulation, by the way, is generally not offered from our side. The defense is the one who asks for the stipulation at trial, because it's the defense who doesn't want us to be able to show the jury what the convictions are and prove the convictions and prove that he knew, because it's something that can be very difficult for the defendant. So they want stipulation. We don't. We're perfectly happy if they want us to go ahead and prove the felony convictions.
But in that case, then what do you do to show that he? That the defendant knew it. That is, let's suppose they didn't make a stipulation and you introduce his conviction. How does that help you satisfy Rehaif these days?
Well, on the felony conviction of 922G is fairly easy. We can get records from guilty pleas, the entry of guilty pleas. We can get records from sentencings where the court advises the defendant that this was a felony conviction, and we can show that the defendant was present. Sometimes they even answer, they acknowledge, yes, I understand this is a felony conviction. So that, and there are many ways. And the fact of numerous felony convictions, I had a case, if it's okay for me to kind of go off record, I had a case where a fella had killed a man and wanted to get rehave relief in the 2255. It's pretty hard to argue that killing a man could have been a misdemeanor. I might not have known whether it was a felony or not. So there are various ways, we have some direct evidence, like I say, of court records, and then there are some reasonable inferences that can be drawn on the type of convictions that a person has, or the severity, basically, of the convictions. If there's something that's not particularly severe, if it's something that, depending on quantity or amount of what was stolen or something that could make it on the line between a felony and a misdemeanor, it could be more difficult. But in that case, we'd probably rely more on court records and what was said to the defendant while
in the court. Fine.
Okay. So I'm happy to answer any of the questions the court might have. Otherwise, Your Honors, we ask the court to affirm the district court on all the issues that Mr. Garrison raised in this appeal. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Reagan?
Your Honor, I'll start. I'm not sure what the time clock is doing, but what I'll say is the government says human error occurs. Where is the prejudice? That's the issue. Yes, where is the prejudice? The prejudice is my client's attorney could not redo his opening statement. He could not shift gears now. And how does he explain to the jury the significance of the failure to disclose? How does the defense attorney make the jury understand that, up until 2 days ago when trial started, I didn't know that they had tested this evidence? What sort of a conclusion is the jury supposed to draw from the defense attorney trying to backpedal now and make the explanation that properly belongs to be made by the government? I don't know, but I do know that it's prejudice in the eyes of the jury. The juries are watching the defense attorneys. They're trying to figure out who's the truth teller here. And the failure to disclose this made the defense attorney look like not a truth teller or somebody who's not enough on the ball to know that in fact there is this evidence. With regard to the rehafe argument, and I appreciate counsel's correction on that because I suspect that that is the correct pronunciation, the double vowel. The court has properly observed that no other circuit, and they've been specific about this, have used the old chief stipulation as it existed pre-rehafe as the thumb on the scale. Every single one of the other cases, including the cases cited by the government in their brief, have looked in the trial record for additional evidence on the reasonable, on whether or not the defendant has satisfied the third plain error prong, and found it. And that's what's missing here. With regard to my client's convictions, that's not the end of it, because certainly that fourth plain error prong can include an unfair, excessively long sentence for the conviction that's at issue. And that's the argument here. This trial was unfair, the conviction on count one is unfair, and upholding it on appeal is fundamentally unfair. And that's my argument for Mr. Garrison.
We thank you both for your good briefing and your arguments today and for working with us electronically. The case will be taken under advisement and an opinion rendered in due course.